The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose Tastytrade. Tastytrade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low-capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tastytrade. Join the club, genius. Tastytrade Inc. is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
I'm Julia Boorstin, and you're listening to CNBC's Tech Check. Our show is live weekdays at 11 a.m. Eastern. Listen in.
Happy Friday. Welcome to Tech Check. I'm John Fort with Carl Quintanilla and Deirdre Bosa. Today, Amazon smashes expectations. One more blowout and a big week for big tech. The stock had a good week. It's up only modestly now. After the news, we will look ahead. And then Twitter tumbles. What went wrong for Jack Dorsey and company as that stock does an Aunt Bunny and falls down the steps, down double digits. And then Beeple's back. The $69 million man that personified the NFT craze joins us with his next project. Carl?
John, a lot of questions for Beeple. Apple is flat to start the trade today, feeling the effects of that EU antitrust charge, which we'll talk about in just a moment. Meantime, Western Digi down after a big beat on revenue and some stronger chip prices, obviously. But overall, tech is challenged today, although the sector has continued to lead the pack this month, thanks largely to blowout earnings from Amazon. An intraday high today, Dee.
That's right, and that is the top of our feed today. Amazon, as big tech continues to just amaze this week with earnings. We saw another huge growth story with sales up 44%, crossing $100 billion in revenue this quarter, the second time it did so. So between the big five guys, Amazon, Apple, Alphabet, Microsoft, Facebook, that's $1.2 trillion in revenue a year, 25% higher than when the pandemic actually started. And our friend Shira Ovidey of the New York Times points out this morning, those five make more in sales in 1 week than McDonald's does all year. And guys, I think she called it bonkers dollars for big tech. That might be a technical term. But this week has been truly, truly astounding. There is no denying that these names are the pandemic economy winners, standing in stark contrast to some of the other sectors and parts of the economy.
Yeah, it helps that an iPhone goes for a lot more, Carl, than a Happy Meal. So I guess they've got that going for them when you look at overall revenue.
Indeed. I mean, and one issue we tried to tackle in the last hour, Dee, was the acceleration at AWS. I mean, the core retail business obviously has huge macro tailwinds. But for AWS to accelerate versus prior quarters and to beat on the margin story, that seems to be where a lot of the focus is today.
Yeah, Bezos calling AWS one of Amazon's children, the other also being Prime, which is 10 years old, and some huge engagement numbers there as well. Engagement numbers up 70% over the last year. We know that they have been spending huge amounts on content, and Amazon CFO telling me too that that's going to continue into this year as well as on things like logistics. We know Amazon's been spending there heavily already. Let's bring in tech investor Keith Raboy, who was an early employee at PayPal, LinkedIn, and Square, and he's now a partner at Founders Fund. Keith, good morning. I know you've been critical of Silicon Valley in the past. After their blowout quarters, though, their record growth, is that a good thing for America?
Well, it's a reflection of the last 10 or 20 years of investment, R&D, intellectual property. So it's manifesting itself right now. We'll see what the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years look like, which I think will be different. But technology takes time to develop, time to ship, time to be adopted by consumers, and time to turn into revenue and monetization. You're seeing the monetization phase, you know, extremely impressively right now.
Okay, so what do the next 20, 30, 40 years look like? They feel invincible at the moment.
Well, generally speaking, technology across the globe will dictate the future of the world. But I believe the headquarters of the companies, the employees of the companies, will be more fragmented. They'll be distributed in Berlin. They'll be distributed in New York. They'll be in Miami. They're not going to be headquartered in Silicon Valley. They're even really not headquartered in Silicon Valley right now. I mean, Amazon Microsoft are not in Silicon Valley. They've never been in Silicon Valley. So two of the four most important tech companies have never been in Silicon Valley. So does not overstate the value of California.
Keith, I wonder, when do you think viewers should expect to start noticing a Jassy effect? Or is the relationship between Jassy and Bezos so symbiotic that you really it'll be hard to notice?
That's a great question. I don't really know the answer. I don't know if anybody at Amazon actually knows the answer. Because when you still have an executive chairman looking over your shoulder, the degrees of freedom you have to do things differently, to change things, are pretty constrained. You know, the Apple transformation was different because, unfortunately, Steve Jobs died. But at least Tim didn't have someone looking over his shoulder. And I think that so it'll take years probably to see a pronounced effect.
Keith, Amazon wins the union vote, hikes pay, crushes earnings. You see all of these strong results across these big technology companies. Does this bode well for them, or does it play into the argument that they're just too big for some people's taste?
Well, I don't see having Amazon having any impact on what I do. If anything, I'm looking for investing in the future of retail, the future of cloud computing. I think people way overrate the effect that Amazon has in the future of technology. There's nothing that's deterring us at Founders Fund from investing in entrepreneurs who have better ideas and better ways of doing things. And Amazon really can't stop that.
So what do you think of what the EU is doing with Apple right now, kind of pushing on the side of Spotify, arguing that what Apple's doing with the App Store, charging competitors that 30%, is anti-competitive? So often, regulators, by the time they identify a problem and crack down on it, somebody's innovated around it anyway. Is this going to slow things down? Does it matter?
Well, the EU has been silly, you know, with respect to competition law for 30 years. This is just a classic example. There's a reason why, you know, entrepreneurs have historically not built impressive companies in Europe. It's because the EU and other regulators there just get in the way of innovating on behalf of society. I used to be an antitrust lawyer back in the 90s. This is totally ridiculous, but it's not the first time that the European Union has been ridiculous using competition law as a political wedge. I saw they're going to try to ban the use of Bayesian theorem, which will be really interesting for the future of Europe if they do that. I saw some data recently that 10 years ago, there was probably about 20 important technology companies in Europe, and today there's probably three. All the rest have either moved to the West or moved to China, and that's the future of Europe if they keep regulating like this.
Keith, did I hear you correctly? You're not worried about Amazon?
I'm not worried about Amazon. It doesn't affect anything I do on a daily basis. It doesn't affect the investments we make. Sorry, go ahead.
Keith, what about in the fintech space? So I know that you have a lot of investments there, and it's long been building a quiet presence in financial services. Its payments technology is really seen as being on the cutting edge. It's about to roll out new technology to Whole Foods stores, potentially license it out, whether that's that Just Walk Out or Palm technology. That doesn't, you know, make you think twice?
No. You know, PayPal's still doing pretty well. Square's doing well. Stripe's doing phenomenally well. Affirm's doing quite well. And these are just the companies that I've invested in.
Okay. Then, Keith, is there anything about any of the big tech companies that you think that they could go into? I know that, you know, some of them are trying to get deeper into the healthcare space. I mentioned payments. Do you think that new businesses are going to be difficult for them to make strides in, given sort of the growing antitrust scrutiny as well?
Yeah, I think that's actually the key issue. I think one of the reasons why I'm not worried about Amazon and we're not worried about large tech companies, Google, Facebook, et cetera, is they really don't hire the right people that can create new businesses from scratch. So it doesn't affect what I do because I'm looking for entrepreneurs that are going to change the world. Elon Musk is not going to work at Google. He's not going to work at Facebook, and he's not working at Amazon. And so as long as Elon Musk doesn't want to work at those companies, I can just give Elon money and he can change the world.
Andy Jassy created AWS within Amazon.
Yes, he did, but he had Amazon as a core customer, and it was a place that a lot of people, maybe almost nobody was looking. So the future, he was able to create an innovative culture, and admittedly, Amazon was better than Google or Facebook at this. He was able to create something, but he had a target customer base of one, and then he turned that into a product for other people. And that's a reasonable strategy for a large incumbent. But Amazon isn't dominating cloud computing. There are plenty of other competitors, large and small.
Keith, I hope you won't mind one question on DoorDash. It's not just about DoorDash, but it's been about 24 hours since Reuters ran this piece with a comment from the Labor Secretary about gig worker classification. Was he over his skis, do you think? And we haven't really heard it from anywhere else. Or is this mark a real turning point in how workers get classified in this country?
Well, I do think we need to innovate. We basically have two poles of how we classify workers, and I think the future will be more of a hybrid model, and that there makes sense to have some social protections that apply to workers who choose a better fate. So I think forcing people artificially to be W-2 employees makes no sense. People who work at DoorDash, let's say Uber, Lyft, are choosing and voting with their feet. They prefer the flexibility and the control of their schedule and the ability to take a day off whenever they want versus working in an office and someone dictating all these things to them. So it's not as if people are choosing artificially to be independent contractors. Many, many, many people in America prefer to be independent. But I think there may be solutions that are somewhat a mix and match strategy. I don't think there's a one size fits all for the future of labor.
Yeah, Keith, along those lines, DoorDash's chief operating officer told me earlier this week that the average hours worked for one of their Dashers is 4 hours a week. So when you consider that, does that person really want to be an employee? And what if they're driving for Uber and Lyft? Are they employee of all three? How do you even do that? And what are the types of benefits in a flexible economy? And I think we should want one. The types of benefits that are most going to support those workers.
Yeah, flexibility is pretty critical. 4 hours a week, it may be a second job. It may be someone who's a student. For example, when I first invested in DoorDash in 2013, many of the drivers, many of the Dashers were actually grad students. And so 4 hours a week makes sense because they can generate incremental income, but they actually can't work 10 hours a week. It would interfere with their academic pursuits. So I think applying rules that make no sense for the future of the world are just going to handicap everybody. Most importantly, it's going to handicap the workers.
You know, there's so much debate around this, Keith, whether making independent contractors employees would actually take away the flexibility. We've actually seen cases in Europe where Just Eat Takeaway has been able to do so and make that model work. So why isn't it sort of something to consider over here in the United States?
Well, I think companies should be liberalized to compete on that basis. If there's a company and a founder and a CEO that wants to compete by hiring employees and making them full-time employees. And there are benefits to the company of doing that. You get to control things. You get a lot more degrees of freedom as a CEO than you would with working with independent contractors. But every business should compete. There's an opportunity for everybody in America to compete for workers. Right now, there's a scarcity of workers who want to work for less than $20 an hour. Every company should have a different model, and people can choose their own adventure. Some people, for example, prefer to drive in a Lyft, then deliver a DoorDash because they don't want to get out of their car. So DoorDash doesn't work for them because they have to deliver the food. Other people don't want to deal with passengers. Passengers can be unruly. They can be drunk. They can be annoying. That's a better choice for someone who's introverted to work at DoorDash where they don't have to interact with passengers. So we need the flexibility for people to choose what jobs, what hours, what terms make the most sense for them. Every American has the right to choose their own work, and we should have different business models and different companies that support each choice.
And they are choosing. It's interesting, though, that you see the ride-sharing delivery companies facing a shortage, but Amazon last night has had no problem hiring, now 1.2 million workers. Anyways, Keith, thank you, as always, for your insights. We'll have you back again soon, I hope.
Pleasure.
It has been a blockbuster week for tech earnings, and we're wondering which company you'd give the Oscar for best performance in a technology role. Even with Netflix out of the running in this one, it is a stacked lineup. So hit us up on Twitter or scan the QR code on your screen. We'll take you to our Twitter at TechCheck, and you can make your case. We will show off the best answers, as always, at the end of the show. Carl?
All right, guys. When we come back, the record-breaking artist Beeple, known for his NFTs, is with us after the break.
What does it mean to be rich? Is it having more stories to share or time to give? Is it being able to keep your loved ones close or travel somewhere far away? At Edward Jones, we believe the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Your dedicated financial advisor will take a comprehensive approach to your financial strategy to help support what truly matters to you. EdwardJones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So
brainstorm got too big. Summarize with AI in a click, click, click. Writer's block. Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
Time for a gut check on Twitter. Shares are plunging after the company reported first quarter earnings that saw beat on the top and bottom lines, but a miss on monetizable daily active users alongside weak guidance. The company also cautioning that it saw several headwinds ahead, ranging from Apple's privacy changes to growing costs and expenses. We will break down the quarter further with Julia Boorstin later this hour. Carl.
Dee, it's been just over a month since this moment, which you'll see, when digital artist Beeple sold his Everyday's NFT for $69 million, as you now know. Since then, we've seen the hype around NFTs skyrocket and recently come back down. Joining us now to discuss his latest collection and the market at large, of course, is digital artist Beeple. Welcome back, man. Good to see you.
Hey, how's it going? How we doing? Tech check. We got a new show here. I'm excited. Snarky Smart. Smart.
And we're honored to have you with us, man. Before we talk about the market, talk about your new portfolio that you're rolling out. How do you describe it? Who's your audience? Is it any different than prior rounds of work?
Honestly, it's not really. I mean, it's something that I think will appeal to crypto collectors, but I think it will also appeal to more traditional physical collectors as well. Dissimilar to the Christie's piece, which was just sort of like a JPEG, this very much has a physical component to the pieces that I'm releasing tonight on niftygateway.com. And I think that's something that there's a lot of room for improvement and sort of like exploration around, because this digital art is, at the end of the day, it's going to be seen in the real world somewhere, whether that's your phone, whether that's a computer screen. So what I want to do is make some really cool screens for people to view this on, and something that feels like it's very a cohesive sort of package with the artwork itself, and something that feels like a physical extension of that digital artwork.
Now, you've been, I think, remarkably wise about this whole opportunity, what it means, where we are in the natural course of these new kinds of innovations. So yep. What have you made about the craze so far, and where we are in that, in which chapter?
Sure. I think people are starting to sort of, you know, maybe take a breath here and kind of resettle and kind of, I think the market is starting to sort of mature. I still think it's insanely early. You talk to the average person, they still have no idea what an NFT is. It's still very much something that I see a massive room for growth. But I think you're seeing people sort of looking for a bit more sort of quality in the releases here, and something that they think is going to retain value long term. And I think that's great. I think that's super healthy for, you know, the whole entire ecosystem.
Let's talk about happy Friday. It's John Ford. Hey. Let's talk about the brand of Beeple. You've been very realistic, I think, about NFTs and the heat around them right now, and how that might cool off. But then your art is surrealist and very the bulls, the one bull mounting the other bull with Bitcoin behind it. It's very much of the moment. Some of these we can't show. Yeah, on how has all of this affected your brand, the way you're expressing through your artwork, and that sort of unique experience that you talked about before that you want to provide for the people who are patrons of your art?
Sure. Honestly, I don't think it's affected my brand that much. I'm still going to do weird stuff. I'm still definitely going to do weird stuff, as you see. But I think, honestly, that's what people like. I think people, that's sort of what got me here, is sort of just doing kind of whatever I want, and sort of, you know, people seem to sort of resonate with that. I think, again, with the physical aspect, I think it's something that really sort of bridges the gap for a lot of people with NFTs. If they're maybe not quite, they're still a little on the fence. I think it's like, well, it's got the NFT, but then you also have the physical as sort of, you know, another way to sort of enjoy this and another way to sort of look at it. I think that is something that is really going to sort of bring in a lot more people to the space and help them, you know, sort of understand this a bit better when they're able to sort of, okay, it's not just something virtual. It also has a physical component. I think that can only sort of add to the experience.
Hi, people. It's Deirdre. I'm glad to hear you will keep things weird. That's what, you know, many love about your artwork. Not to take too hard of a turn, but we have been talking a lot on CNBC about a potential doubling of the capital gains tax. Have you and others in the industry been thinking or talking about it? What would it mean for NFTs and the blockchain technology?
Well, that would probably, to be quite honest, you guys would probably know better than us and me in terms of the sort of tax implications of that. I assume it would not be great, but it's one of those things that, quite honestly, is sort of out of our control and kind of hopefully that, you know, is done in a way that does not hurt business. You know, I hope that's the case. I think there's this stuff is, again, so new that it's a bit gray at the moment. And I think having clarity around that actually long term could really help and sort of legitimize this industry and something that, you know, it's going to need to be sorted out eventually. So we might as well sort it out now so we can kind of move forward with that and plan. But every industry is taxed. I think it's one of those things where it will be what it is. And as soon as we can get that sorted out, we can kind of move forward with that.
Right. That's a good point. Perhaps less trading and more holding if you know you're going to be taxed on your capital gains. People, I don't know if you've seen this. It's the Gardner hype cycle, and it really talks about the importance of technology innovations, and it usually becomes clearer once the hype does die down. Where do you think that NFTs are if we are in such a cycle? Are we still in the hype period? Is it dying down? Are we reaching sort of a plateau of productivity?
I honestly think we're so, so early still. I think this was, you know, I honestly think it's going to take a similar, you know, sort of trajectory to crypto, in which you're going to see like everybody gets excited and then maybe there's, you know, a bit of a softening for a bit. But the technology, again, is so, I believe so strongly in this technology, again, because it's so sort of simple in terms of, you know, just proving ownership, and it can be applied to so many different things, that I think long-term it has such a massive, massive opportunity and massive, you know, possibility of really be looked at as a true alternate asset class, that I think where we are in, you know, over the course of this, you know, 2 months or whatever, I think this is an industry that's going to be around for many, many decades. And so, you know, I'm not super concerned about, you know, where the market is just over the last very, very short term here.
So whether it's other artists, investors, who are you watching in the NFT and art space right now that is making you think that you just think is really smart or innovative?
Gary Vee is coming out with a drop as well on March or May 5th, that I think is going to be really awesome. I think he's coming at this with a very thoughtful, very long-term strategy. And I think he's going to do great. I think he's recognizes that the NFTs, there's no like magic here. There's no sort of trick. If you are making stuff that connects with people on an emotional level and really sort of, you know, has that connection, I think, or it is something that has utility and has real sort of use, I think those NFTs are going to have value. If you are not doing that, I think it is going to be increasingly hard for you to sort of sell NFTs, because I think people are going to be looking for something that connect with them or have uses, and that's where they're going to want to put their money.
Hmm. That's interesting. You know, we've talked to some musicians, for example, some bands like Kings of Leon and Guster that have looked into this, and some argue it's a way for songwriters to finally get past the mess that is the record label and get paid for their songwriting. Is there a use case that you've heard of where you think, I don't really see that working?
I think there are a lot of use cases that I think people are going to test out, and maybe there are some that seem like they'll work, and then, you know, maybe you realize it's like, well, people aren't that interested in that, or it doesn't solve that much of a problem. So I've seen, you know, massive, massive amounts of use cases. I think music in particular is something that is very, you know, has a huge, huge room there. And I actually have a completely other separate project from Beeple that we're going to be ready to show pretty quickly here. So maybe I'll, you know, be back on here, hopefully. but it's definitely, I think we're very much at the beginning of the possibilities here. And it's going to take some time for, you know, some of these to sort of bear out. And I think it's also going to take time for the education piece to really sink in and see if it's like, well, that will work. People just don't know about it. They just don't know about NFTs yet. I think it's too early to sort of, you know, count any ideas out yet. I think it's going to take a second to sort of see where the dust settles with some of this stuff.
In TV, we call that a deep tease, Beeple. We hope you'll come back when you're ready to tell us more.
I'd like to tell you more. We're not quite ready, but I can assure you pretty quickly here we are, and I think it's another exciting NFTs and another way of looking at them that I think will really resonate with people.
Please come back soon. Great seeing you.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much. I appreciate it.
Next, do we have a canary in the coal mine? What's the matter with the bird at Twitter this quarter? Next, the stock now down about 13.5%. The broader market taking another leg lower as well. More on that when Tech Check comes right back.
Canva presents unexplained appearances. It was an ordinary workday until...
That presentation appeared out of thin air.
Also, it's eerily on brand.
Wait, did that agenda just write itself?
Words appear, making this unexplainable case...
Unexplainable? It's Canva's AI tools. I can generate slides and words in seconds.
Really? The real mystery is why I'm only learning this now.
Canva.com. Designed for work.
Happy Friday. Welcome back to Tech Check on what has been an obviously huge week for mega cap tech earnings. I'm Carl Quintanilla with Deirdre Bosa, John Ford. Julia Borsten is out in the field for us. We're going to hear from her in just a minute. We are seeing some selling to end this week. NASDAQ is back below 14K. Amazon did hit an all-time high on that beat from last night. We're watching trading there. Chip makers mostly lower today. Nearly every SMH and SOX component is in the red. EV stocks trying to finish the week on a positive note, although still miles, obviously, from recent highs. A lot to process on this final trading day of the week. In the meantime, let's get a news update here from Rahel Solomon. Hi, Rahel.
Hi, Carl. Good morning. Well, federal stimulus checks helped personal income increase a record 21.1% in March. Spending also rose more than 4%. That is the largest month-over-month increase since last summer. ExxonMobil's first quarter earnings topped forecast despite a $600 million hit to the bottom line from winter storms. Severe weather also cut into Chevron's profits, which were in line with estimates. Clorox earnings coming in 14 cents above expectations, although the company did sharply lower guidance, blaming higher commodity and freight costs. Demand for cleaning and disinfecting products is also down. Clorox shares nearly hitting a 52-week low this morning before rebounding. And Honeywell is leaving the New York Stock Exchange and transferring its listing to the NASDAQ. With the move, there will be seven Dow Industrials listed on the NASDAQ. You're now up to date. John, I'll send it back to you.
Rahel, thank you. Twitter pulled a Netflix. Julia Borsten with us now. Top and bottom line, not bad. The user numbers, not good. What's going on?
Well, John, Twitter did beat on the top and bottom line, but its user numbers came in a million lighter than anticipated. And the company also warned that user growth will slow. But perhaps most concerning for investors is that its second quarter revenue guidance fell short of expectations. The company did not change its long-term goal of doubling revenue by 2023. But Morgan Stanley says that these results may cause some investors to question Twitter's ability to meet or beat its multi-year revenue outlook. And they know note that these results speak to execution challenges that Twitter faces to build a durable advertising business. And I think that we are seeing something interesting here, John, in a divergence between the tech behemoths and the companies like Twitter that are just one step below them. Amazon's ad business is accelerating, and it brought in nearly $7 billion in revenue in the quarter. That's nearly seven times as much as Twitter, just to put that all in context, John.
Yeah, Julia, I'm starting to think maybe Twitter is several steps below some of these. I'm looking now, I look at these Twitter results, I think of Snap. Snap now has twice the market cap of Twitter, up near $100 billion. And the growth at Snap, its daily user growth was 22%. Revenue growth was 66%. How come they are managing to be kind of a niche social player and succeed and Twitter can't?
Well, I think these are two very different companies. And it's interesting, John, that you use the term social player, because Snap would say they're not a social network. They're a communications tool for communicating with your close Thai friends. These are your closest friends. And they are premium content. So that premium content obviously gets higher advertising rates. It's more predictable, et cetera. So Snap is all about this premium experience, whereas Twitter is about communicating with people or following people who you don't know. It's not about those close relationships. And because the content is user-generated, for the most part, it's a little bit more unpredictable for advertisers. So such different companies in terms of the types of relationships on them and also the value to advertisers. And I think when it comes to the reopening play, John, Snap, people are going to be out there making new friends. They want to connect with them, and maybe they're spending less time at home on their computers, toggling between their work and Twitter.
So what does this mean directionally, maybe even strategically, you think, for Twitter? Because I don't see Evan Spiegel getting hauled in front of Congress. I don't see him sweating or worrying about these iOS 14 changes. You know, he's managed to carve out this nice space for himself that is higher growth and apparently lower hassle than Twitter, right?
Lower hassle. I mean, Evan Spiegel has made a big deal for a long time about their commitment to privacy. But I also have to say, Twitter said that while there would be a measurable impact of the iOS changes, it would not be meaningful. So definitely a lower impact in terms of percentage for Twitter than for Facebook. So I don't think they're as much as at risk as many might have thought in terms of that bigger question of, you know, how much ad targeting is going to be limited by Apple's operating system change. But I think directionally, Twitter's trying to diversify its ad base. They have direct response advertising, which is a small but growing part of the business that's been very valuable for other players such as Snap. And I think that Twitter is going to just try to make sure that it has a variety of revenue streams, not just brand advertising going forward.
Hey, finally, Julia, just on engagement, you remember many months ago, people were worried about high profile users exiting, certainly the loss of the former president as a user, but monetizable DAU up 20. I wonder if we can put that debate to bed.
Well, look, yeah, so they added 7 million between Q4 and Q1. The growth is obviously much more significant year after year, versus the year ago quarter. I think that there's no question that Twitter has a very devoted core fan base. The question is just how big it can grow. If you look at Facebook's growth, we're talking about tens of millions of daily active users added just from the prior quarter. So, you know, this is just a different type of service, and I think that they will have meaningful growth. And the question is just how fast you're going to be able to grow once people are out and about again, whereas for Snap, it's really about connecting with new friends. People are going to say, let's connect on Snap after we meet in person. You know, I think Twitter may fall a little bit closer to where Pinterest is in terms of feeling a damage from the world reopening, though perhaps not quite as much as Pinterest feels.
Right. And I always like how Snap was called that in the wild app, less so for Twitter and Pinterest. Julia, thanks so much for bringing that to us. We'll see you in just a little bit. Meanwhile, guys, Jeff Bezos getting active on Instagram. We break that down next and later inside the YOLO trade and what to make of Microvision's turbulent week. Tech Check is back in just two. Amazon's blowout quarter is CEO Jeff Bezos' victory lap before he steps down as CEO later this year. And he looks to be settling into perhaps a more easygoing social media presence now, with that weight of that nearly $1.8 trillion market cap company. Of course, that will soon be off his shoulders squarely, though he'll be involved. Bezos sharing 3 posts in just 24 hours and certainly looking more relaxed here, driving through a desert to an unmanned Blue Origin test landing. This video teasing ahead as Bezos' space exploration company is set to release details on how to buy a ticket on the new Shepard spacecraft. And a bit of a humble brag as well, couldn't help himself, posting about Amazon's winning LinkedIn top spot as the most desired company. Guys, AWS chief Andy Jassy set to take over from Bezos next quarter. We did look for his account, but it appears that Jassy might have a private one. So we will see if he decides to go Insta-public when he takes over the reins, Carl.
Yeah, nothing wrong with a private Insta account. I've got one too, so I can't blame him if that's the case. Guys, let's get our trading boom check. We're watching the YOLO trade. This week's biggest mover is Microvision. Kate Rooney's got some more on it. Hey, Kate.
Hey, Carl. Happy Friday. We've watched this rise of social media discussions and the rise of the stock market on things like Twitter and Reddit. Now we've got some new research showing that it is influencing people's trades, and it's not just millennials and Gen Z. A new survey from investing.com shows just over half of respondents are using some form of social media to research an investment. 20% used Reddit or Twitter to drive some financial decisions, and roughly 7% use Facebook. The numbers are even higher for millennials and Gen Z, who we often think of as those Reddit traders. But among people over 40 years old, still 17% used Reddit for stock picks. And speaking of Reddit, guys, it is Friday, so we've got to bring you some of those highlights. Let's talk about Microvision first, ticker MVIS. We're seeing a lot of that on Wall Street Bets this week. It's been a top mention, and after disappointing earnings this week, there were some disappointed traders on Wall Street Bets today. It has seen a big slide this week. Then over to MindMed. That's the psychedelics company that went public this week. It's also getting a lot of buzz online. And finally, AMD, the chipmaker, with a big beat this week. CEO Dr. Lisa Su becoming a Reddit idol. One post we'll show you right now shows Lisa Su as an action hero. The title of this one, Don't Bet Against the Doctor. Guys, back to you.
Kate, I love that. Joining the ranks of Aunt Kathy, right? When you talk about Microvision, exactly. That's a really interesting case here because we're starting to see a split in the ranks of Reddit investors. There's this sort of thread where earlier Microvision investors, they're upset that Wall Street Bets caught wind of their trade and they're using it to trade, not hold, or H-O-L-D, the stock. Does this suggest that it's, you know, going to be more difficult going forward to sort of the Reddit army, as they've been called, to move stocks in a big way, to coordinate?
There have been some earlier investors, and you see this in crypto, too, where there's some that are early, don't want to sell at it for any reason, and are sort of dogmatic about it. And then there's newer investors who are doing some real research. There is sort of a chasm there on Wall Street Bets. But again, it is sort of seen by a lot of people as sort of fun, entertainment, meme investing. So it's hard often to tell sort of who's the serious investor, who's really got a lot of money on the line, and who's sort of just doing this to make a funny meme and maybe get more followers.
Hmm. Yeah, important distinctions there as you're doing your research, I would think. Kate, thanks. Palantir CEO Alex Karp brought home more than $1 billion in compensation last year. We will tell you how in just a moment. Meantime, one analyst says this stock is, quote, a Goliath on steroids. Ouch. Find out what it is and why on CNBC Pro. We're back in two. New report out today from Microsoft, Amazon, the FBI, and Department of Justice says ransomware is a national security threat and calling for regulation of cryptocurrencies. Our Ayman Jabbers explains. Ayman.
Yeah, John, this is from the Institute for Security and Technology. And what they're saying here, all these member groups contributing to this report on getting their arms around the threat of ransomware, which they do say is a national security threat. And the question is what to do about it. One of the things they're focused on here is cryptocurrency, because that's how the payments are getting made to the bad guys. And they walk us through in the report the actual process by which crypto laundering takes place by the bad guys, starting with taking dollars and turning them into Bitcoin when the victims exchange fiat currency for crypto, then to the payout where the victim sends the crypto to the hacker's wallet. Then they split the spoils. The criminals distribute payments to their affiliates and bosses. Then there's the tumbler process, whereby the payments are mixed with legitimate funds. And then an exchange where criminals sell the mixed crypto on exchanges for foreign fiat currency. And that turns it back into dollars again that the bad guys can use. So the question is, what do you do about all this? Well, here are some of their recommendations from this organization. They're talking about allowing anonymous sharing, incentivizing sharing of wallet addresses, transaction hashes, and ransom notes. Know your customer regulations. They want anti-money laundering regulations to apply in the crypto world. They want SEC enforcement. They want the traditional banks to pursue SEC enforcement of cryptocurrency businesses that fail to register as broker-dealers, for example. And then the old-fashioned one, see something, say something. Exchanges and other crypto players, they say, should file suspicious activity reports, those SARs reports, just like like we see in the financial world. And they also want the IRS to continue its crackdown on tax evasion signatures, which would allow more tracking of some of the bad guys here in this space, John. So a lot of recommendations here. We'll see how many of them are actually put in place in this crypto world, which is sort of like the Wild West right now, as you know.
Yeah, Eamon, some of the numbers in this report kind of staggering. $1/3 billion in ransomware in 2020, up 3x over 2019. We only hear about this sporadically. So even with these changes, since so much of this is done in the shadows, is it clear that it's going to have an impact if they get everything they want?
If they get everything they want, it definitely will have an impact. The question is whether that's possible. You know, you know what happens in this town to these blue ribbon commissions. Now, they say this one is going to get a high level audience here in Washington. But the question is whether all of this is doable. Who will push back on these recommendations? And the big thing to me, I just keep going back to this idea of disclosure. You're talking about all this money that's being paid, and it's being paid in the dark because companies are not disclosing how much they're paying in ransomware payouts. And you've got a problem where a huge section of corporate America is simply sending checks to criminal organizations around the world, in effect, in order to get their data back. That's a real problem for the U.S. economy going forward, because the more you send those checks out, the more you make a market for that, and the more the bad guys are going to say, hey, we can do this too. So I think the problem here is disclosure. We just need to know who's paying and how much as a first starting point, and then we can begin to get our arms around how to deal with the problem.
Right, an important topic. Eamon Javers, thank you so much for that. Another important topic. In 2020, U.S. VC firms deployed a record amount of capital, but the portion of funds to female founders, that actually dropped. And 64% of VC firms, they still have zero female partners. All Raise is a nonprofit on a mission to create greater access in the industry. They just released their annual report detailing some pretty sobering statistics. I spoke to CEO Pam Koska, who says that disrupting the status quo in venture capital is key to diversifying the landscape.
In 2020, a lot of the established firms actually fell back on old behaviors, known networks. And we don't have a pipeline problem. We have a network access problem in the industry. And so we're really looking to increase and expose those amazing founders who are seeking capital and to create these connections and not let the industry fall back on its previous trends.
Pam says that they measure change because you can't change what you don't know. Take out your phone and scan this code. It will take you to our website where you can watch a full piece on the work that All Raise is doing and watch more of our original digital content, cnbc.com/techcheck, where you can also follow our LinkedIn page and Twitter account for even more content. Carl.
Dee, an important story that we're going to continue to cover. When we come back, a look at the pandemic pull forward winners coming up next, the difference between the haves and the have-nots in technology. Later on, Julia Boorstin was the first to tell you about Disneyland's reopening, and today she's there. Julia, what's coming up?
I am back at Disneyland. It's opening after more than 13 months of being shuttered. We'll tell you what's been in the works here at the park when it was closed and what its reopening means for the media giant. That's coming up after the break.
Take a look at Disney's stock. Over the last year or so, it was a huge loser as the pandemic began, as Disneyland movie theaters shut down. Then it came roaring back on the strength of Disney Plus and its streaming strategy. So now, Julia, the in-person part of the business, Disneyland, it's reopening. You're there. Sounds like a perfect storm, is it?
Well, look, the fans are coming into the park. I'm here in Frontierland, and you see people wearing their masks and their mouse ears. And Disneyland's reopening marks the end of a period of massive pandemic-related losses at Disney's Parks Division, about $7 billion in operating profits lost through the end of 2020. We don't have the numbers yet for the first quarter, of course. But now Disneyland Paris is the only park that is still closed. So visitors returning today after temperature checks will find new social distancing measures as well as online food ordering to help reduce lines, plus improvements to rides made during the park's closure. I spoke to Disney's parks chief Josh D'Amaro about the division's work over the past year.
We looked at how can technology help the guest experience, and you've seen some of it already. We have a reservation system that's in place. It helps us with capacity right now. It helps with guest flow. Disney Genie, this is something that's coming soon. I think this is going to revolutionize the theme park industry, specifically for Disney. And you can imagine this is a tool which you basically tell Genie what you want to do, and Genie's in the background reorganizing every minute to make sure that your experience is optimized in the park.
And there are more tech-driven improvements coming. California Adventure, which is also here in Anaheim, is preparing to launch its Avengers Campus on June 4th. And Disney has updated some attractions here, such as the Haunted Mansion, and is keeping some attractions like the monorail closed because of COVID restrictions, and is shortening its Rise of the Resistance ride to meet a 15-minute ride limit. But we won't get details on how many people want to come to the park and what that demand is until earnings, which are in about 2 weeks. But it does seem like tickets for the Disneyland park are sold out for May, and analyst Barton Crockett, Deirdre, he says he expects the parks to be back operating at pre-pandemic revenue levels by their fiscal 2022.
Wow, a quick recovery. No surprise, some pent-up demand there. Julia, thank you so much. Coming up, Alex Karp made over $1 billion last year. Read why on CNBC.com. Plus, the votes are in. Best performance by tech company when we come back.
For our crowdsource, we asked what tech company you thought was the best performer this week. Most responses saying Amazon, following that massive earnings beat. Carl, I think Apple was robbed.
We will see, guys. Next week, another quarter of the S&P is going to print, so enjoy the rest over the weekend.
You've been listening to CNBC's Tech Check. You can always catch us live weekdays at 11 a.m.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.